Smaller drives diminished to $0.06 for a 1 cubic inch reduction. Generally, once the performance level demanded of a particular attribute has been achieved, customers indicate their satiation by being less willing to pay a premium price for continued improvement in that attribute. Hence, performance oversupply triggers a shift in the basis of competition, and the criteria used by customers to choose one product over another changes to attributes for which market demands are not yet satisfied. Another study summarizes what seems to have happened in the desktop PC market. The attribute measured on the vertical axis repeatedly changed. Performance oversupply and capacity triggered the first redefinition of the vertical axis, from capacity to physical size. When performance on this new dimension satisfied market needs, the definition of performance on the vertical axis changed once more to reflect demand for reliability. For a time, products offering competitively superior shock resistance and mean time between failure, MTBF, were accorded a significant price premium compared to competitive offerings. But as MTBF values approached 1 million hours, the shadow price accorded to an increment of 100 hours, MTBF, approached zero, suggesting performance oversupply on that dimension of product performance. The subsequent and current phase is an intense price-based competition, with gross margins tumbling below 12% in some instances. When does a product become a commodity? The process of commoditization of disk drives was defined by the interplay between the trajectories of what the market demanded and what the technology supplied. The 5.25-inch drive had become a price-driven commodity in the desktop market by about 1988, when the 3.5-inch drive was still at a premium price. The 5.25-inch drive, in addition, even though priced as a commodity in desktop applications, was at the same time relative to 8-inch drives, achieving substantial price premiums in higher-tier markets. As described in Chapter 4, this explains the aggressive moves upmarket made by established companies. A product becomes a commodity within a specific market segment when the repeated changes in the basis of competition, as described before, completely play themselves out. That is, when market needs on each attribute or dimension of performance have been fully satisfied by more than one available product. The performance oversupply framework may help consultants, managers, and researchers to understand the frustrated comments they regularly hear from salespeople beaten down in price negotiations with customers. "Those stupid guys are just treating our product like it was a commodity. Can't they see how much better our product is than the competition's?" It may, in fact, be the case that the product offerings of competitors in a market continue to be differentiated from each other. But differentiation loses its meaning when the features and functionality have exceeded what the market demands. Performance oversupply and the evolution of product competition. The marketing literature provides numerous descriptions of the product life cycle and of the ways in which the characteristics of products within given categories evolve over time. The findings in this book suggest that, for many of these models, performance oversupply is an important factor driving the transition from one phase of the cycle to the next. Consider, for example, the product evolution model called the buying hierarchy by its creators, Windermere Associates of San Francisco, California, which describes as typical the following four phases: functionality, reliability, convenience, and price. Initially, when no available product satisfies the functionality requirements, the market, the basis of competition, or the criteria by which product choice is made, tends to be product functionality. Sometimes, as in disk drives, a market may cycle through several different functionality dimensions. Once two or more products credibly satisfy the market's demand for functionality, however, customers can no longer base their choice of products on functionality, but tend to choose a product and vendor based on reliability. As long as market demand for reliability exceeds what vendors are able to provide, customers choose products on this basis, and the most reliable vendors of the most reliable products earn a premium for it. But when two or more vendors improve to the point that they more than satisfy the reliability demanded by the market, the basis of competition shifts to convenience. Customers will prefer those products that are the most convenient to use, and those vendors that are most convenient to deal with. Again, as long as the market demand for convenience exceeds what vendors are able to provide, customers choose products on this basis and reward vendors with premium prices for the convenience they offer. Finally, when multiple vendors offer a package of convenient products and services that fully satisfies market demand, the basis of competition shifts to price. The factor driving the transition from one phase of the buying hierarchy to the next is performance oversupply. Another useful conception of industry evolution, formulated by Jeffrey Moore in his book Crossing the Chasm, has a similar underlying logic, but articulates the stages in terms of the user rather than the product. Moore suggests that products are initially used by innovators and early adopters in an industry, customers who base their choice solely on the product's functionality. During this phase, the top-performing products command significant price premiums. Moore observes that markets then expand dramatically after the demand for functionality in the mainstream market has been met, and vendors begin to address the need for reliability among what he terms early majority customers. A third wave of growth occurs when product and vendor reliability issues have been resolved, and the basis of innovation and competition shifts to convenience, thus pulling in the late majority customers. Underlying Moore's model is the notion that technology can improve to the point that market demand for a given dimension of performance can be satiated. This evolving pattern in the basis of competition, from functionality to reliability and convenience, and finally to price, has been seen in many of the markets so far discussed. In fact, a key characteristic of a disruptive technology is that it heralds a change in the basis of competition. Other consistent characteristics of disruptive technologies. Two additional important characteristics of disruptive technologies consistently affect product life cycles and competitive dynamics. First, the attributes that make disruptive products worthless in mainstream markets typically become their strongest selling points in emerging markets. And second, disruptive products tend to be simpler, cheaper, and more reliable and convenient than established products. Managers must understand these characteristics to effectively chart their own strategies for designing, building, and selling disruptive products. Even though the specific market applications for disruptive technologies cannot be known in advance, managers can bet on these two regularities. 1. The weaknesses of disruptive technologies are their strengths. The relation between disruptive technologies and the basis of competition in an industry is complex. In the interplay among performance oversupply, the product life cycle, and the emergence of disruptive technologies, it is often the very attributes that render disruptive technologies useless in mainstream markets that constitute their value in new markets. In general, companies that have succeeded in disruptive innovation initially took the characteristics and capabilities of the technology for granted and sought to find or create a new market that would value or accept those attributes. Thus, Carner Peripherals created a market for small drives in portable computers, where smallness was valued. J.C. Bamford and J.I. Case built a market for excavators among residential contractors, where small buckets and tractor mobility actually created value. And Nucor found a market that didn't mind the surface blemishes on its thin slab cast sheet steel. The companies toppled by these disruptive technologies, in contrast, each took the established market's needs as given, and did not attempt to market the technology until they felt it was good enough to be valued in the mainstream market. Thus, Seagate's marketers took the firm's early 3.5-inch drives to IBM for evaluation, rather than asking, where is the market that would actually value a smaller, lower-capacity drive? When Bucyrus Erie acquired its Hydro-Hoa hydraulic excavator line in 1951, Its managers apparently did not ask, where is the market that actually wants a mobile excavator that can only dig narrow trenches? They assumed instead that the market needed the largest possible bucket size and the longest possible reach. They jury-rigged the hydro hoe with cables, pulleys, clutches, and winches, and attempted to sell it to general excavation contractors. When U.S. Steel was evaluating continuous thin slab casting, they did not ask, where is the market for low-priced sheet steel with poor surface appearance? Rather, they took it for granted that the market needed the highest possible quality of surface finish and invested more capital in a conventional caster. They applied to a disruptive innovation a way of thinking appropriate to a sustaining technology. In the instances studied in this book, established firms confronted with disruptive technology typically viewed their primary development challenge as a technological one, to improve the disruptive technology enough that it suits known markets. In contrast, the firms that were most successful in commercializing a disruptive technology were those framing their primary development challenge as a marketing one, to build or find a market where product competition occurred along dimensions that favored the disruptive attributes of the product. It is critical that managers confronting disruptive technology observe this principle. If history is any guide, companies that keep disruptive technologies bottled up in their labs, working to improve them until they suit mainstream markets, will not be nearly as successful as firms that find markets that embrace the attributes of disruptive technologies as they initially stand. These latter firms, by creating a commercial base and then moving up market, will ultimately address the mainstream market much more effectively than will firms that have framed disruptive technology as a laboratory, rather than a marketing challenge. 2. Disruptive technologies are typically simpler, cheaper, and more reliable and convenient than established technologies. When performance oversupply has occurred, and a disruptive technology attacks the underbelly of a mainstream market, the disruptive technology often succeeds, both because it satisfies the market's need for functionality in terms of the buying hierarchy, and because it is simpler, cheaper, and more reliable and convenient than mainstream products. Recall, for example, the attack of hydraulic excavation technology into the mainstream sewer and general excavation markets recounted in Chapter 3. Once hydraulically powered excavators had the strength to handle buckets of 2 to 4 cubic yards of earth, surpassing the performance demanded in mainstream markets, contractors rapidly switched to these products, even though the cable-actuated machines were capable of moving even more earth per scoop. Because both technologies provided adequate bucket capacity for their needs, contractors opted for the technology that was most reliable, hydraulics. Because established companies are so prone to push for high performance, high profit products and markets, they find it very difficult not to overload their first disruptive products with features and functionality. Hewlett-Packard's experience in designing its 1.3-inch Kitty Hawk disk drive teaches just this lesson. Unable to design a product that was truly simple and cheap, Kitty Hawk's champions pushed its capacity to the limits of technology and gave it levels of shock resistance and power consumption that would make it competitive as a sustaining product. When very high-volume applications for a cheap, simple, single-function 10-megabyte drive began to emerge, HP's product was not disruptive enough to catch that wave. Apple committed a similar error in stretching the functionality of its Newton instead of initially targeting simplicity and reliability. Performance oversupply in the accounting software market. Intuit, the maker of financial management software, is known primarily for its extraordinarily successful personal financial software package, Quicken. Quicken dominates its market because it is easy and convenient. Its makers pride themselves on the fact that the vast majority of Quicken customers simply buy the program, boot it up on their computers, and begin using it without having to read the instruction manual. Its developers made it so convenient to use and continue to make it simpler and more convenient by watching how customers use the product, not by listening to what they or the experts say they need. By watching for small hints of where the product might be difficult or confusing to use, the developers direct their energies toward a progressively simpler, more convenient product that provides adequate rather than superior functionality. Less well known is Intuit's commanding 70% share of the North American small business accounting software market. Intuit captured that share as a late entrant when it launched QuickBooks, a product based on three simple insights. First, previously available small business accounting packages had been created under the close guidance of certified public accountants and required users to have a basic knowledge of accounting, debits and credits, assets and liabilities, and so on, and to make every journal entry twice, thus providing an audit trail for each transaction. Second, most existing packages offered a comprehensive and sophisticated array of reports and analyses, an array that grew ever more complicated and specialized with each new release as developers sought to differentiate their products by offering greater functionality. And third, 85% of all companies in the United States were too small to employ an accountant. The books were kept by the proprietors or by family members who had no need for or understanding of most of the entries and reports available from mainstream accounting software. They did not know what an audit trail was, let alone sense a need to use one. Scott Cook, Intuit's founder, surmised that most of these small companies were run by proprietors who relied more on their intuition and direct knowledge of the business than on the information contained in accounting reports. In other words, Cook decided that the makers of accounting software for small businesses had overshot the functionality required by that market, thus creating an opportunity for a disruptive software technology that provided adequate, not superior functionality, and was simple and more convenient to use. Intuit's disruptive QuickBooks changed the basis of product competition from functionality to convenience and captured 70% of its market within 2 years of its introduction. In fact, by 1995, QuickBooks accounted for a larger share of Intuit's revenues than did Quicken. The response of established makers of small business accounting software to Intuit's invasion, quite predictably, has been to move upmarket, continuing to release packages loaded with greater functionality. These focus on specific market subsegments, targeted at sophisticated users of information systems at loftier tiers of the market. Of the three leading suppliers of small business accounting software, each of which claimed about 30% of the market in 1992, one has disappeared and one is languishing. The third has introduced a simplified product to counter the success of QuickBooks, but it has claimed only a tiny portion of the market. Performance oversupply in the product life cycle of insulin. Another case of performance oversupply and disruptive technology precipitating a change in the basis of competition and threatening a change in industry leadership is found in the worldwide insulin business. In 1922, four researchers in Toronto first successfully extracted insulin from the pancreases of animals and injected it with miraculous results into humans with diabetes. Because insulin was extracted from the ground-up pancreases of cows and pigs, improving the purity of insulin, measured in impure parts per million, or PPM, constituted a critical trajectory of performance improvement. Impurities dropped from 50,000 ppm in 1925 to 10,000 ppm in 1950 to 10 ppm in 1980, primarily as the result of persistent investment and effort by the world's leading insulin manufacturer, Eli Lilly and Company. Despite this improvement, animal insulins, which are slightly different from human insulin, caused a fraction of a percent of diabetic patients to build up resistance in their immune systems. Thus, in 1978, Eli Lilly contracted with Genentech to create genetically altered bacteria that could produce insulin proteins that were the structural equivalent of human insulin proteins and 100% pure. The project was technically successful, and in the early 1980s, after a nearly $1 billion investment, Lilly introduced its Humulin brand insulin to the market. Priced at a 25% premium over insulins of animal extraction, because of its human equivalence and its purity, Humulin was the first commercial-scale product for human consumption to emerge from the biotechnology industry. The market's response to this technological miracle, however, was tepid. Lilly found it very difficult to sustain a premium price over animal insulin, and the growth in the sales volume of Humulin was disappointingly slow. In retrospect, noted a Lilly researcher, the market was not terribly dissatisfied with pork insulin. In fact, it was pretty happy with it. Lilly had spent enormous capital and organizational energy overshooting the market's demand for product purity. Once again, this was a differentiated product to which the market did not accord a price premium because the performance it provided exceeded what the market demanded. Meanwhile, Novo, a much smaller Danish insulin maker, was busy developing a line of insulin pens, a more convenient way for taking insulin. Conventionally, people with diabetes carried a separate syringe, inserted its needle into one glass insulin vial, pulled its plunger out to draw slightly more than the desired amount of insulin into the syringe, and held up the needle and flicked the syringe several times to dislodge any air bubbles that clung to the cylinder walls. They generally then had to repeat this process with a second, slower-acting type of insulin. Only after squeezing the plunger slightly to force any remaining bubbles, and inevitably, some insulin, out of the syringe, could they inject themselves with the insulin. This process typically took 1 to 2 minutes. Novo's pen, in contrast, held a cartridge containing a couple of weeks' supply of insulin, usually mixtures of both the fast-acting and the gradually-released types. People using the Novo pen simply had to turn a small dial to the amount of insulin they needed to inject, poke the pen's needle under the skin, and press a button. The procedure took less than 10 seconds. In contrast to Lilly's struggle to command a premium price for Humulin, Novo's convenient pens easily sustained a 30% price premium per unit of insulin. Through the 1980s, propelled largely by the success of its line of pens and premixed cartridges, Novo increased its share of the worldwide insulin market substantially and profitably. Lilly's and Novo's experiences offer further proof that a product whose performance exceeds market demands suffers commodity-like pricing, while disruptive products that redefine the basis of competition command a premium. Teaching the Harvard Business School case to executives and MBA students about Lilly overshooting the market demand for insulin purity has been one of my most interesting professional experiences. In every class, the majority of students quickly pounce on Lilly for having missed something so obvious, that only a fraction of a percent of people with diabetes develop insulin resistance, and that the differentiation between highly purified pork insulin at 10 ppm and perfectly pure Humulin was not significant. Surely, they assert, a few simple focus groups in which patients and doctors were asked whether they wanted pure insulin would have given Lilly adequate guidance. In every discussion, however, more thoughtful students soon begin to sway class opinion toward the view that, as we have seen over and over, what is obvious in retrospect might not be at all obvious in the thick of battle. Of all the physicians to whom Lilly's marketers listened, for example, which ones tended to carry the most credibility? Endocrinologists, whose practices focused on diabetes care, the leading customers in this business. What sorts of patients are most likely to consume the professional interests of these specialists? Those with the most advanced and intractable problems, among which insulin resistance was prominent. What, therefore, were these leading customers likely to tell Lilly's marketers when they asked what should be done to improve the next generation insulin product? Indeed, the power and influence of leading customers is a major reason why companies' product development trajectories overshoot the demands of mainstream markets. Furthermore, thoughtful students observe that it would not even occur to most marketing managers to ask the question of whether a 100% pure human insulin might exceed market needs. For more than 50 years, in a very successful company, with a very strong culture, greater purity was the very definition of a better product. Coming up with pure insulins had always been the formula for staying ahead of the competition. Greater purity had always been a catching story that the sales force could use to attract the time and attention of busy physicians. What in the company's history would cause its culture-based assumptions suddenly to change and its executives to begin asking questions that never before had needed to be answered? Controlling the evolution of product competition. Another study summarizes the model of performance over supply, depicting a multi-tiered market in which the trajectory of performance improvement demanded by the market is shallower than the trajectory of improvement supplied by technologists. Hence, each tier of the market progresses through an evolutionary cycle marked by a shifting basis for product choice. Although other terms for product life cycles would yield similar results, this diagram uses the buying hierarchy devised by Windermere Associates, in which competition centers first on functionality, followed by reliability, convenience, and finally price. In each of the cases reviewed in this chapter, the products heralding shifts in the basis of competition and progression to the next product life cycle phase were disruptive technologies. The study shows the strategic alternatives available to companies facing performance oversupply and the consequent likelihood that disruptive approaches will change the nature of competition in their industry. The first general option, labeled Strategy 1, and the one most commonly pursued in the industries explored in this book, is to ascend the trajectory of sustaining technologies into ever higher tiers of the market, ultimately abandoning lower-tier customers when simpler, more convenient, or less costly disruptive approaches emerge. A second alternative, labeled Strategy 2, is to march in lockstep with the needs of customers in a given tier of the market, catching successive waves of change in the basis of competition. Historically, this appears to have been difficult to do, for all of the reasons described in earlier chapters. In the personal computer industry, for example, as the functionality of desktop machines came to satiate the demands of the lower tiers of the market, new entrants, such as Dell and Gateway 2000, entered with value propositions centered on convenience of purchase and use. In the face of this, Compaq responded by actively pursuing this second approach, aggressively fighting any upmarket drift by producing a line of computers with low prices and modest functionality targeted to the needs of the lower tiers of the market. The third strategic option for dealing with these dynamics is to use marketing initiatives to steepen the slopes of the market trajectories so that customers demand the performance improvements that the technologists provide. Since a necessary condition for the playing out of these dynamics is that the slope of the technology trajectory be steeper than the market's trajectory, when the two slopes are parallel, performance oversupply and the progression from one stage of the product life cycle to the next does not occur, or is at least postponed. Some computer industry observers believe that Microsoft, Intel, and the disk drive companies have pursued this last strategy very effectively. Microsoft has used its industry dominance to create and successfully market software packages that consume massive amounts of disk memory and require ever faster microprocessors to execute. It has essentially increased the slopes of the trajectories of improvement in functionality demanded by their customers to parallel the slope of improvement provided by their technologists. The effect of this strategy is described in another study depicting recent events in the disk drive industry. Notice how the trajectories of capacity demanded in the mid-range, desktop, and notebook computer segments kinked upward in the 1990s, along a path that essentially paralleled the capacity path blazed by the makers of 3.5-inch and 2.5-inch disk drives. Because of this, These markets have not experienced performance oversupply in recent years. The 2.5-inch drive remains locked within the notebook computer market because capacity demanded on the desktop is increasing at too brisk a pace. The 3.5-inch drive remains solidly ensconced in the desktop market, and the 1.8-inch drive has penetrated few notebook computers for the same reasons. In this situation, the companies whose products are positioned closest to the top of the market, such as Seagate and IBM, have been the most profitable, because in the absence of technology oversupply, a shift in the stages of the product life cycle at the high end of the market has been held at bay. It is unclear how long the marketers at Microsoft, Intel, and Seagate can succeed in creating demand for whatever functionality their technologists can supply. Microsoft's Excel spreadsheet software, for example, required 1.2 megabytes of disk storage capacity in its version 1.2, released in 1987. Its version 5.0, released in 1995, required 32 megabytes of disk storage capacity. Some industry observers believe that if a team of developers were to watch typical users, they would find that functionality has substantially overshot mainstream market demands. If true, this could create an opportunity for a disruptive technology. Applets picked off the Internet and used in simple Internet appliances, rather than in full-function computers, for example, to invade this market from below. Right and wrong strategies. Which of the strategies illustrated in the study is best? This study finds clear evidence that there is no one best strategy. Any of the three, consciously pursued, can be successful. Hewlett-Packard's pursuit of the first strategy in its laser jet printer business has been enormously profitable. In this instance, it has been a safe strategy as well, because HP is attacking its own position with disruptive inkjet technology. Compaq Computer and the trinity of Intel, Microsoft, and the disk drive makers have successfully, at least to date, implemented the second and third strategies, respectively. These successful practitioners have in common their apparent understanding, whether explicit or intuitive, of both their customers' trajectories of need and their own technologists' trajectories of supply. Understanding these trajectories is the key to their success thus far. But the list of firms that have consistently done this is disturbingly short. Most well-run companies migrate unconsciously to the Northeast, setting themselves up to be caught by a change in the basis of competition and an attack from below by disruptive technology. Chapter 10. Managing Disruptive Technological Change, a Case Study. As we approach the end of this book, we should better understand why great companies can stumble. Incompetence, bureaucracy, arrogance, tired executive blood, poor planning and short-term investment horizons obviously have played leading roles in toppling many companies. But we have learned here that even the best managers are subject to certain laws that make disruptive innovation difficult. It is when great managers haven't understood or have attempted to fight these forces that their companies have stumbled. This chapter uses the forces and principles described in earlier chapters to illustrate how managers can succeed when faced with disruptive technology change. To do so, I employ a case study format, using a personal voice, to suggest how I, as a hypothetical employee of a major automaker, might manage a program to develop and commercialize one of the most vexing innovations of our day, the electric vehicle. My purpose here is explicitly not to offer any so-called right answer to this particular challenge, nor to predict whether or how electric vehicles may become commercially successful. Rather, it is to suggest in a familiar but challenging context how managers might structure their thinking about a similar problem by proposing a sequence of questions that, if asked, can lead to a sound and useful answer. How can we know if a technology is disruptive? Electric-powered vehicles have hovered at the fringe of legitimacy since the early 1900s, when they lost the contest for the dominant vehicle design to gasoline power. Research on these vehicles accelerated during the 1970s, however, as policymakers increasingly looked to them as a way to reduce urban air pollution. The California Air Resources Board, CARB, forced an unprecedented infusion of resources into the effort in the early 1990s, when it mandated that starting in 1998, no automobile manufacturer would be allowed to sell any cars in California if electric vehicles did not constitute at least 2% of its unit sales in the state. In my hypothetical responsibility for managing an automaker's program, my first step would be to ask a series of questions. How much do we need to worry about electric cars? That is, aside from California's mandate, does the electric car pose a legitimate disruptive threat to companies making gasoline-powered automobiles? Does it constitute an opportunity for profitable growth? To answer these questions, I would graph the trajectories of performance improvement demanded in the market versus the performance improvement supplied by the technology. In other words, I would create for electric vehicles a trajectory map similar to one of two earlier studies. Such studies are the best method I know for identifying disruptive technologies. The first step in making this study involves defining current mainstream market needs and comparing them with the current capacity of electric vehicles. To measure market needs, I would watch carefully what customers do, not simply listen to what they say. Watching how customers actually use a product provides much more reliable information than can be gleaned from a verbal interview or a focus group. Thus, observations indicate that auto users today require a minimum cruising range, that is, the distance that can be driven without refueling, of about 125 to 150 miles. Most electric vehicles only offer a minimum cruising range of 50 to 80 miles. Similarly, drivers seem to require cars that accelerate from 0 to 60 miles per hour in less than 10 seconds, necessary primarily to merge safely into high-speed traffic from freeway entrance ramps. Most electric vehicles take nearly 20 seconds to get there. And finally, buyers in the mainstream market demand a wide array of options, but it would be impossible for electric vehicle manufacturers to offer a similar variety within the small initial unit volumes that will characterize that business. According to almost any definition of functionality used for the vertical axis of our proposed chart, the electric vehicle will be deficient compared to a gasoline-powered car. This information is not sufficient to characterize electric vehicles as disruptive, however. They will only be disruptive if we find that they are also on a trajectory of improvement that might someday make them competitive in parts of the mainstream market. To assess this possibility, we need to project trajectories measuring the performance improvement demanded in the market versus the performance improvement that electric vehicle technology may provide. If these trajectories are parallel, then electric vehicles are unlikely to become factors in the mainstream market. But if the technology will progress faster than the pace of improvement demanded in the market, then the threat of disruption is real. Another study shows that the trajectories of performance improvement demanded in the market, whether measured in terms of required acceleration, cruising range, or top cruising speed, are relatively flat. This is because traffic laws impose a limit on the usefulness of ever more powerful cars, and demographic, economic, and geographic considerations limit the increase in commuting miles for the average driver to less than 1% per year. At the same time, the performance of electric vehicles is improving at a faster rate, between 2 and 4% per year, suggesting that sustaining technological advances might indeed carry electric vehicles from their position today, where they cannot compete in mainstream markets, to a position in the future where they might. In other words, as an automotive company executive, I would worry about the electric vehicle, not just because it is politically correct to be investing in environmentally friendly technologies, but because electric vehicles have the smell of a disruptive technology. They can't be used in mainstream markets. They offer a set of attributes that is orthogonal to those that command attention in the gasoline-powered value network, and the technology is moving ahead at a faster rate than the market's trajectory of need. Because electric vehicles are not sustaining innovations, however, mainstream automakers naturally doubt that there is a market for them, another symptom of a disruptive innovation. Consider this statement by the director of Ford's electric vehicle program. The electric Ranger will sell at approximately $30,000 and have a lead-acid battery that will give it a range of 50 miles. The 1998 electric vehicle will be a difficult sell. The products that will be available will not meet customer expectations in terms of range, cost, or utility. Indeed, given their present performance along these parameters, it will be about as easy to sell electric vehicles into the mainstream car market as it was to sell 5.25-inch disk drives to mainframe computer makers in 1980. In evaluating these trajectories, I would be careful to keep asking the right question. Will the trajectory of electric vehicle performance ever intersect the trajectory of market demands, as revealed in the way customers use cars? Industry experts may contend that electric vehicles will never perform as well as gasoline-powered cars, in effect comparing the trajectories of the two technologies. They are probably correct. But recalling the experience of their counterparts in the disk drive industry, they will have the right answer to the wrong question. I also would note, but not be deterred by, the mountain of expert opinion averring that without a major technological breakthrough in battery technology, there will never be a substantial market for electric vehicles. The reason? If electric vehicles are viewed as a sustaining technology for established market value networks, they are clearly right. But because the track records of experts predicting the nature and size of markets for disruptive technologies is very poor, I would be particularly skeptical of the experts' skepticism, even as I remain uncertain about my own conclusions. Where is the market for electric vehicles? Having decided that electric vehicles are a potentially disruptive technology, my next challenge would be to define a marketing strategy that could lead my company to a legitimate, unsubsidized market in which electric cars might first be used. In formulating this marketing strategy, I would apply three findings from earlier chapters in this book. First, I would acknowledge that, by definition, electric vehicles cannot initially be used in mainstream applications because they do not satisfy the basic performance requirements of that market. I would therefore be sure that everybody having anything to do with my program understands this point. Although we don't have a clue about where the market is, the one thing we know for certain is that it isn't in an established automobile market segment. Ironically, I would expect most automakers to focus precisely and myopically on the mainstream market because of the principle of resource dependence and the principle that small markets don't solve the growth and profit needs of big companies. I would not therefore follow the lead of other automakers in my search for customers, because I would recognize that their instincts and capabilities are likely to be trained on the wrong target. Nonetheless, my task is to find a market in which the vehicles can be used, because the early entrants into disruptive technology markets develop capabilities that constitute strong advantages over later entrants. They're the ones that, from a profitable business base in this beachhead market, will most successfully throw impetus behind the sustaining innovations required to move the disruptive technology upmarket toward the mainstream. Holding back from the market, waiting for laboratory researchers to develop a breakthrough battery technology, for example, is the path of least resistance for managers. But this strategy has rarely proven to be a viable route to success with a disruptive innovation. Historically, as we have seen, the very attributes that make disruptive technologies uncompetitive in mainstream markets actually count as positive attributes in their emerging value network. In disk drives, the smallness of 5.25-inch models made them unusable in large computers, but very useful on the desktop. While the small bucket capacity and short reach of early hydraulic excavators made them useless in general excavation, their ability to dig precise, narrow trenches made them useful in residential construction. Odd as it sounds, therefore, I would direct my marketers to focus on uncovering somewhere a group of buyers who have an undiscovered need for a vehicle that accelerates relatively slowly and can't be driven farther than 100 miles. The second point on which I would base my marketing approach is that no one can learn from market research what the early markets for electric vehicles will be. I can hire consultants, but the only thing I can know for sure is that their findings will be wrong. Nor can customers tell me whether or how they might use electric vehicles, because they will discover how they might use the products at the same time as we discover it. Just as Honda's Super Cub opened an unforeseen new application for motorbiking. The only useful information about the market will be what I create through expeditions into the market, through testing and probing, trial and error, by selling real products to real people who pay real money. Government mandates, incidentally, are likely to distort rather than solve the problem of finding a market. I would, therefore, force my organization to live by its wits rather than to rely on capricious subsidies or non-economic-based California regulation to fuel my business. The third point is that my business plan must be a plan for learning, not one for executing a preconceived strategy. Although I will do my best to hit the right market with the right product and the right strategy the first time out, there is a high probability that a better direction will emerge as the business heads toward its initial target. I must therefore plan to be wrong, and to learn what is right as fast as possible. I cannot spend all of my resources or all of my organizational credibility on an all-or-nothing first-time bet, as Apple did with its Newton, or Hewlett-Packard did with its Kitty Hawk. I need to conserve resources to get it right on the second or third try. These three concepts would constitute the foundation of my marketing strategy. Potential markets. Some speculation. What might emerge as the initial value network for electric vehicles? Again, though it is impossible to predict, it almost surely will be one in which the weaknesses of the electric vehicle will be seen as strengths. One of my students has suggested that the parents of high school students who buy their children cars for basic transportation to and from school, friends' homes, and school events might constitute a fertile market for electric vehicles. Given the option, these parents might see the product simplicity, slow acceleration, and limited driving range of electric vehicles as very desirable attributes for their teenagers' cars, especially if they were styled with teenagers in mind. Given the right marketing approach, who knows what might happen? An earlier generation met a lot of nice people on their Hondas. Another possible early market might be taxis, or small parcel delivery vehicles destined for the growing, crowded, noisy, polluted cities of Southeast Asia. Vehicles can sit on Bangkok's roads all day, mostly idling in traffic jams, and never accelerating above 30 miles per hour. Electric motors would not need to run, and hence would not drain the battery while idling. The maneuverability and ease of parking of these small vehicles would be additional attractions. These or similar market ideas, whether or not they ultimately prove viable, are at least consistent with the way disruptive technologies develop and emerge. How are today's automobile companies marketing electric vehicles? The strategy proposed here for finding and defining the initial market for electric vehicles stands in stark contrast to the marketing approaches being used by today's major automakers, each of which is struggling to sell electric vehicles into its mainstream market in the time-honored tradition of established firms mishandling disruptive technologies. Consider this statement made in 1995 by William Glaub, Chrysler General Sales Manager, discussing his company's planned offering for 1998. Chrysler Corporation is preparing to provide an electric-powered version of our slick new minivan in time for the 1998 model year. After an in-depth study of the option between a purpose-built vehicle and modification of an existing platform, the choice of the minivan to use as an electric-powered platform, in retrospect, is an obvious best choice for us. Our experience shows that fleets will likely be the best opportunity to move any number of these vehicles. The problem that we face is not in creating an attractive package. The new minivan is an attractive package. The problem is that sufficient energy storage capacity is not available on board the vehicle. To position its offering in the mainstream market, Chrysler has had to pack its minivan with 1,600 pounds of batteries. This, of course, makes its acceleration much slower, its driving range shorter, and its braking distance longer than other available gasoline-powered automobiles. Because of the way Chrysler has positioned its electric vehicle, industry analysts naturally compare it to gasoline-powered minivans, using the metrics paramount in the mainstream value network. At an estimated cost of $100,000, compared with $22,000 for the gasoline-powered model, nobody in their right mind would consider buying Chrysler's product. Chrysler's marketers are, naturally enough, very pessimistic about their ability to sell any electric minivans in California, despite the government's mandate that they do so. William Glaub, for example, continued the remarks cited before with the following observation. Markets are developed with fine products that customers desire to own. No salesman can take marginal product into the marketplace and have any hope of establishing a sustainable consumer base. Consumers will not be forced into a purchase that they do not want. Mandates will not work in a consumer-driven, free market economy. For electric vehicles to find a place in the market, respectable products comparable to today's gasoline-powered cars must be available. Chrysler's conclusion is absolutely correct, given the way its marketers have framed their challenge. Mainstream customers can never use a disruptive technology at its outset. What should be our product, technology, and distribution strategies? Product development for disruptive innovations. Guiding my engineers in designing our initial electric vehicle will be a challenge because of the classic chicken and egg problem. Without a market, there is no obvious or reliable source of customer input. Without a product that addresses customers' needs, there can be no market. How can we design a product in such a vacuum? Fortunately, the principles described in this book give us some help. The most valuable guidance comes from Chapter 9, which indicated that the basis of competition will change over a product's life cycle, and that the cycle of evolution itself is driven by the phenomenon of performance oversupply, that is, the condition in which the performance provided by a technology exceeds the actual needs of the market. Historically, performance oversupply opens the door for simpler, less expensive, and more convenient, and almost always disruptive, technologies to enter. Performance oversupply indeed seems to have occurred in autos. There are practical limits to the size of auto bodies and engines, to the value of going from 0 to 60 in fewer seconds, and to the consumer's ability to cope with overchoice in available options. Thus, we can safely predict that the basis of product competition and customer choice will shift away from these measures of functionality toward other attributes, such as reliability and convenience. This is borne out by the nature of the most successful entrants into the North American market during the past 30 years. They have succeeded not because they introduced products with superior functionality, but because they competed on the basis of reliability and convenience. Toyota, for example, entered the U.S. market with its simple, reliable Corona, establishing a low-end market position. Then, consistent with the inexorable attraction to migrate upmarket, Toyota introduced models such as Camry, Previa, and Lexus with added features and functionality, creating a vacuum at the low end of the market into which entrants such as Saturn and Hyundai have entered. Saturn's strategy has been to characterize the customer's entire experience of buying and owning the vehicle as reliable and convenient, but it, too, judging by recent reports, will soon take its turn moving upmarket, creating a new vacuum at the low end for even simpler, more convenient transportation. In all likelihood, therefore, the winning design in the first stages of the electric vehicle race will be characterized by simplicity and convenience. and will be incubated in an emerging value network in which these attributes are important measures of value. Each of the disruptive technologies studied in this book has been smaller, simpler, and more convenient than preceding products. Each was initially used in a new value network in which simplicity and convenience were valued. This was true for smaller, simpler disk drives, desktop and portable computers, hydraulic backhoes, steel mini-mills as opposed to integrated mills, insulin-injecting pens as opposed to syringes. Using these qualities as my guiding principles, I would instruct my design engineers to proceed according to the following three criteria. First, this vehicle must be simple, reliable, and convenient. That probably means, for example, that figuring out a way to recharge its batteries quickly using the commonly available electrical service would be an immutable technological objective. Second, because no one knows the ultimate market for the product or how it will ultimately be used, we must design a product platform in which feature, function, and styling changes can be made quickly and at low cost. Assuming, for example, that the initial customers for electric vehicles will be parents who buy them for their teenaged children to drive to and from school, friends' homes, and activities, the first model would have features and styling appropriate and appealing to teenagers. But although we may target this market first, there's a high probability that our initial concept will prove wrong. So we've got to get the first models done fast and on a shoestring, leaving ample budget to get it right once feedback from the market starts coming in. Third, we must hit a low price point. Disruptive technologies typically have a lower sticker price per unit than products that are used in the mainstream, even though their cost in use is often higher. What enabled the use of disk drives in desktop computers was not just their smaller size, it was their low unit price, which fit within the overall price points that personal computer makers needed to hit. The price per megabyte of the smaller disk drives was always higher than for the larger drives. Similarly, in excavators, the price per excavator was lower for the early hydraulic models than for the established cable-actuated ones, but their total cost per cubic yard of earth moved per hour was much higher. Accordingly, our electric vehicle must have a lower sticker price than the prevailing price for gasoline-powered cars, even if the operating cost per mile driven is higher. Customers have a long track record of paying price premiums for convenience. Technology strategy for disruptive innovations. Our technology plan cannot call for any technological breakthroughs on the path critical for the project's success. Historically, disruptive technologies involve no new technologies. Rather, they consist of components built around proven technologies and put together in a novel product architecture that offers the customer a set of attributes never before available. The major automakers engaged in electric vehicle development today all maintain that a breakthrough in battery technology is absolutely essential before electric vehicles can be commercially viable. John R. Wallace of Ford, for example, has stated the following. The dilemma is that today's batteries cannot satisfy these consumer needs. As anybody who is familiar with today's battery technology will tell you, electric vehicles are not ready for prime time. All of the batteries expected to be available in 1998 fall short of the 100-mile range required by consumers. The only solution for the problems of range and cost is improved battery technology. To ensure a commercially successful electric vehicle market, the focus of our resources should be on the development of battery technology. Industry efforts, such as those through the U.S. Advanced Battery Consortium, along with cooperative efforts among all electric vehicle stakeholders, such as utilities, battery companies, environmentalists, regulators, and converters, are the most effective way to ensure the marketability of electric vehicles. William Glaub of Chrysler takes a similar position. The advanced lead-acid batteries that will be used will provide less than the fuel storage equivalent of 2 gallons of gasoline. This is like leaving home every day with the low fuel light on, In other words, the battery technology is simply not ready. The reason these companies view a breakthrough in battery technology as the critical bottleneck to the commercial success of electric vehicles, of course,